Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with
Alex Garland.
Alex, it's a thrill for you to be in here. Thanks so much for coming on WTOP to talk about your new movie, Ex Machina. It's been out a couple weeks now, but I take my hat off to you. It's not only brilliant science fiction, but it's also a really engaging, sometimes creepy thriller, but it poses some profound questions and even a little romance all rolled into one. So hats off on that. This is your directorial for a feature, right?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I've been working film for about 15 years, but yeah.
Right. Whenever I have a filmmaker in, I like to kind of see the career trajectory, how we got to the film first, and then
gotcha.
So I know for you, you wrote the novel for The Beach, right?
Mm-hmm.
Worked with Danny Boyle with that. And then you wrote the original screenplay for 28 Days Later.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of came at it from a different perspective, but how did working with Danny plant seeds that maybe I want to direct as well?
I'm not really sure it did. I mean, like you said, I used to write books, and then I sort of transitioned from books into film. And it wasn't so much working with Danny; it was the whole thing. It was working with a crew and working with actors. And actually, in a way, as a writer, my primary relationship was with a producer. Writers and producers often have a particular bond because they're the people that start a project. Mm. A writer writes a script, and then the first person on board is a producer. And usually the writer and producer sort of back the thing backwards and forwards for a while, and then a director is attached way down the line. And but really it was just the whole thing of working on film. I enjoyed it. It was collaborative, and wanted to keep doing it, I guess.
In terms of the way it's directed, for instance, a particular scene, it's after one of the first power surges when the power goes out. And it's the first time the AI says, don't trust Oscar Isaac's character.
Yeah.
The scene that directly follows that, where Oscar Isaac's talking to the protagonist, and there's that first hint where we, the audience, know something that Oscar Isaac may not.
Yeah.
It's sort of shot like this master shot sequence, but immediately pop in for the close up there. There's little things like that where, you can see that you know, I mean, that's you working with the editor too, but you can really see there's a strong director at work, and he's got that weird animal head hanging behind him, a little creepy mise-en-scene like he's being watched. I mean, how do you go about constructing a scene like that? Do you decide that's where I want my close up, or is that more in the editing room?
Well, partly it comes from having spent a lot of time in an edit and thinking on previous films, man, I wish we had a shot of this, or I wish we had a shot of that. And then you carry that forwards and you learn as you go. But in terms of the actual process of shooting a scene like that, basically what you do is you've got the script. Everyone agrees what they're trying to do and what the place looks like, and you know where you are and the sort of basic plans. Then you get the actors in the space, and probably that's the first time they've been there. And you just rehearse it, and you block the scene, which means largely the actors block the scene. They decide, here I'm going to stand up, or here I'm going to reach for that glass of wine, whatever it happens to be. And then really it's an open conversation initially with the DOP, the two of you, the director of photography. You've been watching how the scene played out, and everyone's made their adjustments. And then you think, so what's the right feeling? What, you know, maybe, and this could be Rob, the DOP, suggesting it, or it could be me, or it's often very informed by what the actors have done and the sort of vibe and where they're putting gear changes. And you say, okay, well, if we're starting wide, maybe we start to push in slowly here, or dolly in, or whatever it happens to be. And typically my process is block the scene with the actors, then turn to the DOP and say, Rob, how do you want to shoot it?
Right.
You know.
Do you view kind of your approach to directing kind of like what they're saying about the Jackson Pollock painting, kind of, what does he say? Automatic artistry, whether it's you have this huge plan and you know where you're going to put the dot, or do you need to maybe have a blueprint, but go a little with the flow and be flexible?
More the latter. I've got a clear idea in my head about what the scene is and why it's there and what the important things that we need to convey about the scene are. And then, with that knowledge, the trick then is, from my point of view, not to get too rigid and to be able to hear what people are saying and suggesting, and also be able to recognize what the actors are changing and adapting. So going with the flow is, for me, a very, very big part of it. And I can't underscore enough, I'll use the word again, collaboration. That is absolutely fundamental to it. I think where I felt I've watched people go wrong before, in whatever capacity it is on a film, it's to do with not really recognizing the collaboration and being too rigid. And I think the rigidity often in a way looks like it comes from fear. You know, you've got an idea, you're feeling very anxious, and so you want to hold on to it, and you can't open your mind to fluidity. And a lot of my effort is to do with making sure I can hear a good idea when somebody else suggests it.
Speaking of the collaboration, the musical score, is it an xylophone or what is that? It sounds a little Close Encounter sometimes with the doom, doom, doom.
Yeah, so the particular instrument that's used with Ava to score her, mm-hmm. the robot, is I think it's called a celeste. It has a kind of purity about it. We can sort of associate it in some ways with like nursery chimes or,
right.
you know, noises from childhood in some respects, a music box or something like that.
Right.
And I think it's a way of underscoring her apparent purity and the degree to which we should trust her, maybe.
And just going further down the idea of collaboration, the effects of the AI, how exactly was that achieved? Because it's remarkable to watch play out. You know, you have a real face of the actress, but the face comes up higher than the rest of her scalp, which is, you know, robotic, and the same thing with the arms. And, you know, how was that whole look conceived?
A little group of us designed Ava together, and this was a $15 million film, and so we didn't have a lot of money to splash around, but we also knew we had this huge VFX component. And so one of the things we did, one of the ways you can lose a lot of money in film production is to not be sure about what the VFX component is, how it's going to look, and to continue to adapt it and change it as you're filming. I guess this is in a way contradiction to what I was just saying. This particular thing, we really needed to lock it down and feel very, very sure. Right. And so basically, we came up with a design, a group of us together, and then the VFX guys said, you got to shoot this film in 6 weeks, which is a very accelerated shooting schedule. You don't have time to worry about the VFX. We are going to deal with it. Don't worry about it. Just shoot the actors. Shoot it as drama. There's going to be no green screen. There's going to be no tracking markers. Just shoot the people, and we will swap it all out later. And what they did was they gave themselves an incredibly complex task to achieve in post-production. And what the production then did was give ourselves a very long post-production. So we never handed a shot over them to say, this is one you've got to do, unless we were sure it was going to be in the film.
So how does Ava look on set then? You know, they're saying just direct it with the, you know, block it like they're just sitting there and we'll add it later. So what's she wearing it?
So if you can picture the image of Ava where she has a kind of gray mesh and a solid form in some parts of her body, like her shoulders and her chest and her hips, and then a transparent sort of skeletal form in other parts of her body, the gray mesh covered her whole form. So she kind of looked like a gray Spider-Man. And that's what she wore on set. And that gave Alicia, the actress, something to inhabit and feel. I don't look, you know, I'm not just wearing jeans and a t-shirt. There's something different about me. And allowed her, yes, to get somewhere closer to that machine and that role. And then it was really just over to the VFX guys to do some real artistry and create, you know, things where they don't exist and pluck them out of the air, really.
Equally, if not more important than the VFX, is the casting of Alicia herself. Mm-hmm. I mean, how did you go about choosing her for the role, and B, sculpting her, you know, little tics and mannerisms that is that slight hint of a robot, but it's still very human.
Well, that was very much Alicia. She, I mean, the basic thing with this movie is, it's a film that puts a lot of pressure on actors. I think probably more pressure on actors in some respect than anybody else on the production. Mm-hmm. And so first and foremost, we just needed top quality actors. And once we had that, then I tried to give as much autonomy to the actors as possible to sort of inhabit the part. And Alicia came up with a bunch of ideas about Ava, which was to do with the way she'd move, which would not be robotic. It would be a kind of too perfect version of the way humans move. Mm-hmm. And then she added these tiny little things, and she developed it as it went along. And really, by the end of the rehearsal period, she had, I would say, a very complete sense of what Ava was like. It's not like it developed over the shoot. She had Ava kind of in her bones, as it were.
How did you choose her to begin with?
I'd seen her in this Danish movie, A Royal Affair, and she's very, very striking. She was very young when she acted in that, probably 20 or 21, and she's acting opposite an incredibly powerful, established middle-aged actor Mads Mikkelsen is, you know, brilliant performer, and yet this young girl is sort of owning the movie in some respects and carrying these scenes on her shoulders, and that's always striking when you see that. So I knew she was an amazing actress, and then we spoke, and she reacted to the script, and she said some extremely perceptive things, and she put a reading of herself down on tape, and it was a kind of slam dunk. But I have to say, even before she did the reading, I knew she was right and wanted her. In a way, the reading was more just, it allowed the case to be made to the financiers, I think, more than to me and the producers.
Yeah. And, you know, I think your movie's going to open up even more doors for her. I mean, she's going to be a real star.
She's got plenty of doors already open.
she doesn't need me for that.
No, she really, really doesn't. She's got like 4 more massive movies.
Nice.
And I mean, like, good. Not little indie movies like this one, sort of proper big movies.
Right.
And,
good.
She's in good shape.
Good. She deserves it. How about Oscar Isaac? I mean, you know, had you seen Llewyn Davis or Most Violent Year, or I guess how long had you been working on Ex Machina?
Yeah, Most Violent Year shot after us, and Llewyn Davis shot before, but I hadn't seen it. Mm-hmm. I didn't see Llewyn Davis until we'd wrapped, actually. And
so you cast Oscar Isaac independent of both those movies.
Independent of both those movies, but there is a thing that happens in the film industry where there's a lag, that everybody knows these guys are good, and then they land like 2 or 3 years later, and that's something to do with the cycle of films.
Gotcha.
I knew, and everybody knew at that time, how good Oscar was. It was no secret. And there were lots of people trying to get him to do other projects. And so... it wasn't like any prescience on my part at all.
It
looks different from the outside. There's always some people that are being buzzed about who won't really land for another 2 or 3 years. And of course, not all of them will land. That's in the nature of film. But he all of these actors were buzzy at the time I cast them, all of them.
Just speaking of Isaac's role, there was a scene early in the movie where I thought maybe you were going to go for a big, you know, Deckard, Blade Runner, is he one of his own robot type things. When he first mentions the Turing test, I think he calls it, and he says, to see if you can tell you're working with, speaking with AI. I was like, oh, maybe he's one of them. But did that ever noodle in your mind? Or I guess maybe that wouldn't have spoiled the whole thing you were going for.
No. I mean, that... It was something I thought about, but not thought about as something that the film was then going to aim for, but more actually using it, because I know that a sort of literate sci-fi familiar audience is going to start to suspect everything because of the nature of this kind of story. And so there are little nudges to sort of push people towards that direction, like oddly symmetrical scars on somebody's back, or... Right. A sort of story about a car crash that seems slightly too convenient, or whatever it happens to be. And what that does is it serves to take attention away from some of the other things that are going on, and to, in a way, use the literacy of the audience as a plot development technique.
Absolutely. And with the role of Ava, and then last year we had Scarlett Johansson playing, you know, Under the Skin, another sci-fi movie.
And Her, where she played.
And Her, course, the year before, both brilliant. What do you think it is? I mean, you said the acting things move in cycles, but do you think premise-wise and story-wise and theme-wise things move in cycles too, where we have these sci-fi movies dealing with, you know, women's sexuality and what's going on under the skin in all these different types of movies? I mean, what's making that pop right now in this time in the universe?
I do believe in zeitgeist. I remember back in the 80s, there suddenly being this flood of Vietnam War movies. There was Full Metal Jacket and Platoon and Hamburger Hill, and they just sort of arrived, and it happens. It's cyclical. Why it happens and being able to anticipate what it's going to be in another few years, that's kind of like a dark art. In a way I've got no idea. I suspect in the case of the AI stuff, it just stems from a generalized anxiety and fear of tech companies, government agencies, the phones in our hand, the laptops in our office, and feeling that these things understand a lot about us and we don't understand much about them. And that then gets transmuted and manifested as AI cautionary tales, something like that.
We've talked a lot about you as a director in this movie. What about you as the writer? What sparked this idea? What got you going down this path?
It was an interest in, initially it was an interest in artificial intelligence and reading up about it and trying to get my head around some of the issues to do with it. And when you start reading about issues of strong AI, so not the AI in your phone or on a video game, right, but sort of self-aware AI, it inevitably then becomes a discussion about what self-awareness is, and that becomes a discussion about us, about what human consciousness is. And then as soon as you've got the idea of a sort of, it's like a perfect sci-fi conceit. By looking at a robot, you're actually looking at humans, and then you're looking at the way humans and machines and then humans and humans interact with each other and how we establish what's going on in each other's minds or fail to establish what's going on, that became like a really interesting subject matter, it felt like, for a movie.
Yeah. Absolutely. I've been in AI the whole time we've been talking, and you didn't even notice.
I kind of did. No, I'm kidding.
That's hilarious. So what's next going forward? I know you wrote Halo, right?
No, I wrote that. We're talking about like 13 years ago. I was contracted by Microsoft. I wrote a script. I handed it over. Then I got sacked, and I never heard anything about it again. So it's more than 10 years
ago. So that's been a long waiting forever. And then what about, you have Annihilation, right? That's a book adaptation.
That's what I'm trying to set up at the moment. Yeah. So tomorrow or the day after, I think I'm having a meeting with some important guy to try and get money to make that movie up.
What's that one about?
It's based on this novel by a guy called Jeff Vandermeer, and it's about a group of women that enter into a sealed off area of North America, sealed off by the government, to figure out and to discover what's happening inside. And so it's about what they discover there, really.
Cool. And there's also been rumors, maybe of a 28 months later. There was a 28 days and 28 weeks. Is that all just speculation?
The rights for that were frozen for a long time between all the people that made the first one, which is Danny and Andrew and me and Fox. And we decided that it might be a sort of an idea to look at it. I'm not really involved in that. That's Andrew McDonald, the producer, and and he's... Yeah, he's investigating. He's paid someone to write a script, and I hope it's good because I get a passive payment out of it. So I'd like it to get made.
Exactly. It can only benefit you. Is science fiction something you think you're going to grapple with for the rest of your career?
I like sci-fi. I like sci-fi because you can put big ideas in it and not be embarrassed and sort of awkward about it.
Right.
You put some of this stuff in a thriller or an adult drama, and people almost feel embarrassed. You know?
Right.
But yeah, sci-fi gives a lot of permissions, and I like that a lot. But, you know, whatever. You know, I keep thinking about political thrillers at the moment, so maybe something like that.
Do you have a favorite political thriller?
Oh, I've got loads.
Parallax View, All the
Parallax
President's
View's Men. Fantastic. All the President's Men is fantastic. 3 Days of the Condor. Yeah. I do like those 70s paranoid.
7 Days in May. Well, I guess that's 60s, but yeah.
Yeah, but the 70s sort of paranoid, the sort of post-Watergate conspiracy thrillers are pretty fantastic.
Yeah. Is that also because you can do big ideas? I mean,
I think it's just because they're kind of electrifying. Yeah. Like there's something. I think the 70s is kind of a golden era of cinema.
No doubt about it.
You were able to get a certain kind of adult drama, and a lot of people would turn up to watch it.
Yeah.
And it gave a lot of fantastic filmmakers a fantastic opportunity.
Yeah, I think if I had to put the dates on it, I'd say it was probably about 67 to 1980. That like little window, because 67 was Graduate,
so
Bonnie and Clyde,
it?
All that stuff, and then maybe Raging Bull in the end. But
so go on, why did it all stop?
Why do you think it did?
I'm asking you.
Oh, I think, I mean, I'm looking at it from, you know, 50,000 feet on the other side of the coast, but I think it was the sequel-driven 80s, man. I think, I think you had some really great, you know, you had kind of Jaws, which was a great movie, kind of set it off. Star Wars also, really original imagination, but great movies themselves, but spawned a culture of let's just revive everything and not have more movies like Ex Machina, which is, you know, this original seed. I think that's kind of where we went off the rails, but
I think sequels, I think I would agree with that. Yeah, sequels were dangerous in all sorts of ways. I mean, it's problematic because, of course, some sequels are great.
Right, The Godfather Part 2.
Yeah, but actually Empire Strikes Back,
absolutely.
Is a, you know, you can make a reasonable case that that's the best of those Star Wars movies to date. Who knows what this new one's going to be like.
But, So yeah, it's not, I mean, I guess it's... there's always exceptions to the rule. I don't know. That was my what do you have a take on it?
I think you're pretty on the money. Or put another way,
follow the money.
Well, yeah, exactly. The thing that underlies a lot of this is money. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you look at Exorcist or Alien, like would those films be massive movies now? I don't think they would.
Right. And it's those are the directors that, you know, it was, you had Friedkin makes, you know, French Connection wins Best Picture, but then goes.
Oh, and there's two. There's another sequel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, yeah.
The Exorcist just had sequels too.
No, but Alien didn't French Connection as well.
There was just this flowering of all these great filmmakers popping up. But also, I think more of it was the audience appetite to go see it. I mean, it was.
There was that. There's one thing I do think, and it's the area that television, American television particularly, has occupied, which is that there was a period where adults made films for other adults.
Yeah.
And then I think increasingly what happened was adults made films for kids.
Right.
Now, that's a massive generalization, but there's a sort of underlying truth to it.
Generally,
nonetheless, yeah. And when I think of the 70s films I really love, they are films that are aimed basically at adults. They've got mature themes, and they've got complicated ethics, and they're gray in all sorts of areas. And they're not primarily visceral entertainment. There's some kind of agenda going on there. That could be The Godfather or Apocalypse Now or Parallax View or 3 Days of the Condor or whatever it happens to be.
Funny you mentioned Apocalypse Now. I thought of Colonel Kurtz a little with Oscar Isaac, just off on his little isolated little, you know, talking about these big themes that he's kind of, you know, slowly. I mean, he's the only one he has in there to talk to other than these bots. But
no, we used to talk about that too with me and Oscar. I mean, really? Too much time up river. And we used to talk about Kurtz.
You mentioned Kurt, so I wasn't picking that up on my own.
Absolutely, we spoke about Kurtz quite a lot.
Nice. Maybe it's more of a Dennis Hopper in Apocalypse. We can land on a fraction.
Sort of dude speak stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, just to wrap up, is there any way we can get that back where the film industry is making it more for adults? Or
well, I think there's lots of people who are. I think the Coen brothers and people, Anderson, and there are people out there, apps 100% doing it. You know, I loved Inherent Vice, and so it's absolutely out there. But the real place it exists these days is American drama on television.
Yeah, Mad Men, Sopranos, all that stuff.
If you get the feeling, if Tennessee Williams was around now, he'd write for American TV, and it would be something like Mad Men. I mean, it's
so. Is that something you want to do? Television?
No, not really. Not really. I read some article the other day that is what I was doing, and I was thinking, what am I? I didn't know that. I like film. I like cinema. I like the fact that it's kind of a short form medium, it's a story in an hour 45
self-contained
or 2 hours.
Story
and there's a kind of compactness to it, and it doesn't, there's something scary about, from a writer's point of view. I'm a writer basically, and writing gives you get lots of freedoms in television, but man, you've also come up with 700 page script, and I kind of prefer to write 110 page script. That's more my speed.
Absolutely. Is there anyone out there right now in the film industry then that's really, you know, kicking ass that you would really admire?
Oh yeah, loads. I mean, I just said actually, Coen Brothers and Anderson and
P.T. Anderson or
P.T. Okay. Oh, both.
Right.
But I really loved Inherent Vice and There Will Be Blood, I thought was a spectacular piece of filmmaking.
Fantastic.
And, there's a lot of people out there. There's a lot of people out there. When I see Llewyn Davis, when I finally got to see it, it really blew me away. Mm-hmm. It's not whether it's getting made or even whether it's getting supported by financiers and distributors. It's actually audiences.
Right.
That's the truth.
True.
That's the underlying truth that people tend not to talk about. It's like, oh, the film industry.
Blame the studio. Blame yourself. Look in the mirror. What are you going to see?
Because people will watch it on television, but they don't want to go to the cinema to see it so much. And, you know, I kind of get that. I'm not apportioning blame, except actually I am.
Well, we can certainly blame you for a great, fascinating little movie here. So congratulations on Ex Machina.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for coming on WTOP.
That was a pleasure.